You don't have to be enlightened to observe the ease that your ethical discipline creates around you. That's really very beautiful. Now I have another quote. Again, from one of the great Indian Mahayana masters. So he's saying, sila is called ethical discipline. And I'm not going the etymology, but he's referring to etymology. So it's called ethical discipline as such. Why? Because it does not acquiesce in the afflictions. What does acquiesce mean? That's right. You give into you, and acquiesce. Yeah, it just has this meaning of yielding to, or giving something, or allowing something in, offering something to that thing. Yes. So it doesn't acquiesce in the afflictions. What do you think the afflictions are here? Yeah, that's right. And in particular, the afflictions, like the hatred that would cause somebody to kill, the greed that would cause somebody to steal, the greed and confusion that pushes people for sexual misconduct, the greed, the irritation, and the confusion that pushes people to lie and to deceive, to speak harshly, to divide people with their speech, and to waste their time with useless talk, right? So ethical discipline does not acquiesce in the afflictions. It's called as such because it allows no regrettable, transgressive thing, harmful thing to arise. It allows no harmful thing to arise. It's beautiful psychology in Buddhism, very subtle and delicate. It's called ethical discipline because it doesn't allow harm to arise, harmful actions. It's called ethical discipline because it is coolness, since it quells the fires of regret. Now, this also is a beautiful metaphor. And Upandita, in The State of Mind Called Beautiful, he also has very eloquent passages of deeply beautiful words talking about how affliction chars the mind, that regret darkens and chars the mind. Oh, it's really so strong. So this not allowing harm to arise, it's cooling. You can imagine, so here we are in New Mexico, you can imagine what it's like in the peak of summer. Do people feel that the heat is oppressive? They do, don't they? You see, they like to wear these straw hats or on like this. Same in Asia. That there are times when, you know, particular seasons, and you know, especially like when at the end of the monsoon, when the sun starts to come out again, you feel so unprotected. That cloud cover is dissipating and that sun is like an anvil on your head because your head is shaved. Right? Anyway, even if it isn't shaved, there's a Burmese saying about how the heat of that season kills the baby shrimp. So everybody feels it, right? So do you think that people feel relieved and protected by coolness? They do. They feel that coolness it allows them to feel normal, relaxed, undistressed. How about the symbol of the lotus? I know you all see lotuses every day, don't you? Anyway, it's a it's the a beautiful kind of translucent, extraordinary white color to the petals of the lotus. Of course, and then they rise up over the ponds. You see them in the swaying in the wind. So that's a very cooling metaphor in the Oriental mind, that when you see the lotus, it's so pure, even though the roots are in the mud. It's a very uplifting and inspiring, refreshing, cooling image.
Even as an herb in medicine, it's used to cool the heart.
Oh, is that right? Right. Oh, that's lovely. So Chandrakirti goes on and he says, it's called ethical discipline because it is that upon which the outstanding people rely. They rely on it because it's the cause of happiness. He goes on, he says, the seven abstentions, so abstentions, as we talked, those are the abstaining from, the refraining from, the seven abstentions of unskillful bodily and verbal actions. And these abstentions are motivated by the three qualities, non-attachment, non-hostility, and correct view. Therefore, ethical discipline is explained as the 10 paths of action in terms that include this wholesome motivation. So when we talk about the beauty, beneficence, the healing properties of ethical discipline, then we're back to contemplating the specific qualities of what's wholesome. In any moment of non-attachment, of not attaching to irritability, anger, aggression, in any moment of having confidence in the causality, the cause and effect of karma, we see within that a mind which is healthy. And how would a person, what's like the indicator for health? Is, in fact, the state of feeling untroubled, unafflicted, free of illness, mental states, mental factors that support mental health, and a stable mind. And do you think that just naturally, whenever such a state would arise, that a person would intuitively recognize that as goodness? Yeah, of course. So the second one, so the first one is to be free of illness. The second attribute of wholesome mental states is that it's morally faultless, unstained. Factors which render the mind clean and clear, not stained or murky. So, right. When it comes up into the mind that you have a wish to speak harshly, and if you have mindfulness, it's strong enough to really go into that and examine that, hold that impulse. You will find this sense of that the mind is unsettled and unclear, that there's a murkiness to it, a kind of, hard to put exact words, a darkness to it. Anyway, just coming back to this murkiness, you look for it. So that's number two. That's not stained and not murky, clean and clear. Anyway, but I do just want to go back into this just for a second, that that there is a kind of intuitive sense of the cleanliness and brightness and goodness that that is also associated with the stability of mind. And otherwise, the stability of mind, you could argue that slothfulness, say, would be stability of mind because the mind is so unmoving. But it's not like that. The mental factors of mindfulness, of non-attachment, kindness, compassion, all those things, they have that brightness and that sense of inner cleanliness. I love all these metaphors, you know, it's all very poetic and artistic. So there is another image that comes to mind, that if you had a person, or if you were a person who was bathed, or like get into an oriental mood, so it's not just showering, you really bathed, and then there are unctions, so there are perfumes, and maybe also like powders and stuff like that, so that people really, you know, very beautifully, in a way, like refreshed with their shower and their bath. And then such a person would put on a very beautiful suit or dress for going out for some important, like dinner or function or something like that. So just connecting with this sense of cleanliness and cleanness also with the clothing and beauty. So a person like that, you know, they would be horrified if you like put a like the carcass of a rotting fish on them. Yeah. They would feel like deeply mortified, made dirty. Yeah. So the inner sensitivity from the mindfulness and the concentration is like this bathing and perfuming and dressing very, very beautifully, and of being presented, you know, with like the prospects of elegant activity, right? So that's a very beautiful thing, that to feel that sense of cleanliness and purity, and even that like recoiling from defiling that cleanliness and purity. That's a kind of wisdom and discernment that's connected with your just a very intuitive sense of what's pure and good. So number three. The third attribute of kusala is that it is based on wisdom or wise reflection and intelligence. And yesterday in the guided meditation, I talked about it and I said that the attributes, the characteristics of hindrances is that your mind is not able to think of in a broad way, that you're only able to think in a really narrow way, and that is a problem. Because there are other ways of thinking about your context that you need to have access to. Anyway, that narrow way of thinking is characteristic of hindrances. And in a way, recognizing that in the operation of a hindrance is like a tool that you take hold of to allow yourself to wiggle out of the influence of the hindrance and to bear some context. So here we have the third attribute of wholesome things is wisdom or intelligence. That means that you're able to bear, to engage in investigation, to bear in mind the Dharma that you have listened to, contemplated, practiced, and realized. And then also you can imagine that in a moment of, say, you know, that some like sexual misconduct possibility offers itself to you, or some gossip opportunity offers itself to you, and if given that opportunity, what arises in your mind is a wish not to pick that thing up because of the intuition, the studied intuition that it will just lead to no good. It will lead to destabilizing, lack of composure, dissipation, a kind of ugly agitation. So that's it. That's your experience of the wise reflection and connected with intelligence attribute of wholesome mental states. It's that you look at that, and it becomes the symbol or the sign of distress instead of the symbol or sign for happiness. Wise reflection, clear thinking. The fourth attribute of wholesome mental states is well-being. Oh, this is a really precious richness. The wholesomeness is a condition that produces contentment. When wholesome conditions arise in the mind, there's naturally a sense of well-being without the need for any external influence. So when one feels healthy, freshly bathed, clean, and in a safe and comfortable place, then a sense of well-being naturally follows. So I'm going to remind you, in the very first day, we talked about the kusha grass. That is the etymology for kusala comes from the kusha grass. And why is it called that? Because it has the activity of destroying unwholesome mental states. It has the activity of shaking them, cutting them through. The unwholesome ones can keep you busy and distracted and stupid, unreflective, disturbed, and all the rest of it can keep you going like that for indefinitely. But the unskillful ones don't have the power to uproot and to destroy the wholesome native intuition or the wholesome intelligence or the wholesome, the natural intuition of seeing a superior kind of happiness. Those unwholesome things, they can't destroy that. They can't destroy that intuitive native intelligence. They can make you very confused so that you can't get access to that. But they can't destroy it. Whereas the wholesome ones, which are based in an understanding of of a natural law of what's a superior happiness, the wholesome ones can weaken the influence, break it up, circumstance by circumstance, until that wisdom matures and there's a deep understanding of reality. Oh, no, actually, I'm okay. It's a little dry tickle in the throat. Who can say what the five great gifts are? You remember that from the first day? There are these five great gifts. Which five? Contentment definitely is going to underlie them. Oh, actually, I have throat lozenges. The five great gifts. Here we go. There is a case where a disciple of the Noble Ones, abandoning the taking of life, abstains from the taking of life. In doing so, they give freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, and so, like, I want to talk about this a little bit more. Freedom from oppression to limitless numbers of beings. So freedom from danger, that's straightforward, huh? I was going to put it there. Freedom from danger because that beings don't have to fear that there's going to be some aggression that's going to overwhelm them. Freedom from animosity. So in refraining from aggravating beings, beings don't feel aggravated. They feel relaxed. They don't have, you don't cook up antagonism in them. And what do you think? Do beings enjoy feeling antagonistic on account of being disturbed? If somebody disturbs them and they feel antagonistic, do people like that? No. So it's very shanti, it's very peaceful. One is offering freedom from danger. In offering freedom from danger, one is additionally relaxing them, allowing them just to relax. Freedom from oppression to limitless numbers of beings. Okay, so yesterday I was saying for the Akusala ones, there's a whole list of things that if you do, then you participate in that. So now we're going to talk about Kusala, the skillful things. So if you offer to beings the gifts of freedom from taking life, freedom from harming, freedom from taking what's not given, if you offer them the gift of you're not going to initiate any sexual misconduct scenarios. If you're going to offer them skillful speech, if you're going to offer them, in this case, the fifth one is the not using intoxicants, which doesn't get reckoned in the 10, but anyway, it gets reckoned in the 5. So if you offer that all the way down to the freedom from that you yourself are not taking intoxicants, you're offering beings a freedom from danger, a freedom from animosity, and a freedom from oppression. So when you offer those, you're giving those as a gift. That's something that you do. So that's karmic wholesomeness, right, that will come back for you, that supports you. So if you do it, if you encourage somebody else, no need to kill that thing. Don't take that thing which is not given to you. You better be careful about this temptation possibility. Mind your mouth. And, you know, be careful about how much you're drinking. If you encourage someone like that, then that also is powerful, wholesome karma for you. If people are all talking, you know, a social situation, people are relaxing, enjoying nicely, and you see that, you know, and somehow or other you're with people and they're not aggressive, they're not killing things, you know, the ants, the bugs, and the mosquitoes in the picnic, and you approve of that, you also, this is wholesome karma for you. if they also, you see that they don't take what's not given and you approve, you mentally like agree, that's good, then that's wholesome, powerfully wholesome for you. All the way down, the sexual misconduct, speech, like maybe something has happened and your friend like really suffered to refrain from making a comment, and then they come back and they tell you, oh, when he said this, I just wanted to say this, this, and that, right? And you encourage them, like now you can tell me how much you're suffering, but that is great that you didn't say that, right? I'm really supporting you and letting you now release that energy of that frustration. If we speak in praise of non-harming, if we speak in praise of refraining from stealing, if we speak in praise of refraining from sexual misconduct, in praise of skillful speech, and in abstaining from intoxicants, then we also, then all of these things become like fourfold that we ourselves are doing, we encourage others to do, we approve of, and we speak in praise of. That's like a fourfold exponential, powerful, wholesome karma for us. This is from the questions of King Melinda. After the time of the Buddha, then you had, there was a Greek, like Alexander the Great came in, charging into India. And he couldn't get so far. You know, it was a long military campaign at one of the western rivers, the Bias River, the whole thing fell apart. But he left some Bactrian Greek, like rulers in local vicinities of Greek extraction. And these Greeks, they took a real interest in the Indians, the Indian sages, and then it's a kind of a courtly thing that people really enjoy to learn philosophy, and to discuss and to debate. Very cool. Anyway, so there was the king, King Melinda. He was a very sharp-witted guy, very interested in knowing the truth, and he like didn't want any lily-leafed answers. So the monks were kind of intimidated by him, and they had to go get Nagasena. Naga is a celestial serpent, like an Indian dragon. Sena, oh, I'm missing that part of the etymology. I can't say what that is. But anyway, Nagasena is a great name. But if you're born on a Saturday, you can't get that name. Anyway, so they went and they got Nagasena. Nagasena is way cool. Very deep practice and very articulate. So they're in the middle of this discussion, and then King Melinda asks Nagasena, so tell me about mindfulness. What characterizes mindfulness? And Nagasena says, discernment, not wandering, taking up, promoting things, acknowledging, and being able to keep in mind. And then he goes on, he says, as mindfulness springs up in the mind of one devoted to mental training, that person repeatedly notes, like I was telling you, soft mental noting, come face to face, acknowledge. That person repeatedly notes the wholesome and the unwholesome, the blameless and the blameworthy, the low and the lofty, the dark and the light qualities. And that person identifies them as, this is mindfulness of the body. This is mindfulness of pleasant and unpleasant feeling tone. This is mindfulness of the mental states. This is mindfulness of hindrances. This is mindfulness of rapture. This is mindfulness in understanding the nature of things. Then the one who is devoted to mental training then follows the things that should be followed and does not follow the things that should not be followed. Like when you hear things like this, sometimes it's just nice to have a little pause and to place your sense of aspiration and agreement. Like, may my practice also be like that. Clear, discerning, decisive. What is blameworthy? What is blameless? What is low? What is lofty? And then let me follow the things that should be followed, and let me not follow the things that should not be followed. The one who is dedicated to mental training associates with that which should be associated with and does not associate, like does not entertain in their mind the things that should not be associated with. This is the way that noting is a distinguishing mark or characteristic of mindfulness. And how, so the Melinda is asking further, you tell me more about this. How is this taking up, this promoting a mark, an activity of mindfulness? So Nagasena answers, when mindfulness arises in one, the one who's devoted to mental training examines the qualities of mental states that are beneficial and detrimental, and that person wisely reflects, these mental states are helpful, and these mental states are not helpful. Thus, the one who is devoted to mental training removes the detrimental mental states and takes up the beneficial states. That person removes the unhelpful mental states and takes up the helpful mental states. And so it's like this. This is distinguishing, is the mark of mindfulness. So I want to say one last thing about this. To give careful consideration to ethical discipline, to arouse, you reflect on the skill that you have already, and you put in place the aspiration, right? So right now, when we're talking about karma, we're talking about the activities that are done that should be cut off. So this is you'll keep on with this kind of attentiveness and care for your actions throughout the entirety of your spiritual life, all the way till you get to be an arhat, bodhisattva, Buddha. But the beginnings to orient, to stabilize, to mature, to culture the psyche in the person, to make that person ready for the deeper work of meditation, of insight, that ethical discipline is the very important starting point. Because of the compassion, because of the meaning value that one appreciates living beings and one does not want to hurt living beings. And then it causes one to examine carefully one's own inner world, the urges, the impulses, the motivations. So this is the beginning of mental training, of mental development. So it takes discernment, discrimination, motivation, compassion, great qualities. Then these are brought into the solitude of the meditation endeavor, the silence in which increasingly the mind is purified of obsessive urges, motivations, thinking, unprofitable cycles of thought. So that makes the mind, again, Anana, what do I want to say here? Again, I'm just pointing out that, that endeavor of purifying the mind from obsessive patterns of thinking and distorted tracks, that takes a strong psyche. It will strengthen also the psyche, but it takes a strong psyche. Somebody who's not losing track of the basics, compassion, relatedness, non-harming, much more could be said about that world of purification, of concentration. And then as a result of the strengthening of the mind, quickening of mindfulness, the strength and power of the mind in concentration, one starts to appreciate this world, which now we've been have so long been depending on for our entertainment, satisfaction, our sense of stability and reliability. This world, in fact, it is not at all what we thought it was. It is so impermanent. It is so given to quick reversals. It is so marked by the oppression in terms even of experiencing it, oppression. So do you think that this is relaxing to realize? Do you think that to have the whole world turned upside down in the very fine field of your meditative awareness, do you think that this makes you feel secure? It does not, right?
Well,
so,
you know, I mean, I think about, I see how my mental states change. Like, one second I love something, the next second I hate it.
Yeah, that's right.
You know? And so seeing that,
sure,
is really freeing.
Yeah, of course it is. Oh yeah, I'm not saying that it's like taking you into a hellhole, right? But I'm just coming at it at an angle that there's the path of disillusionment is disturbing also. Yeah.
Well, for me, there's like an underlying tension of having to constantly know that it's changing. A lot of what I try to do is keep myself safe, secure.
Right, there are two levels of dukkha, of course, and one early on and continuously sees that there's a level of dukkha that is just not worth experiencing or bearing, that this is what can be removed, right? So we're talking about you seeing the suffering, but at the same time, to see the impermanence of what you thought was beautiful and stable and that you thought was going to be reliable, and then the path of wisdom and insight is taking you deeper and deeper into seeing that this whole world is really very groundless. Like, I'm just like going to sign on the dotted line and say there are really challenging aspects to the unfolding of insight. So this ethical discipline is a support for you, and it's a continuous. It supports you through the beginning, the middle, and the end of your practice. It is a refuge that connects you with the beauty and support of the knowing mind, feeling a support even in the disillusionment about what you thought was real, and now you see that impermanence is real. It supports you in the development of your practice. And what I want to make a point here, because people will feel like, oh, we're going, like Buddhism is going to take us into nihilism, into, stripping away the meaning of everything, that nothing is going to exist. It's so, like, extreme. For a person who is well established in ethical discipline, they will not suffer the distress of the faulty thinking that emptiness is nihilism, And they will feel intuitively more strength and more confidence in a relational way. Yes. So I just say it generally, they feel more strength and confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha as a support for them, the beginning, the middle, and the end of practice. Anyway, this could be the beginning of like another, like 3 weeks of all being in retreat, in which we go now into like the Four Noble Truths, dependent origination, the stages of insight, what is Nibbana, Nirvana, what is emptiness, what is the Bodhisattva path, and what is the path of the Arhat, on like this. Yeah, sure. Make prayers of aspiration that you can finish what has been begun. So for me, awesome to be able to have this opportunity. Also, you know, to have Tenzin Jesse helping me absolutely full on with the unfolding of this. It's like I say, I never got this kind of extensive discussion of karma in my own Theravada life. This is something that Tenzin Jesse and I teach every year in the arc of the yearly teachings that progresses through the topics of what's called the Lam Rim, the graduated stages of the path. I feel that the benefits of going into this are just immense. And even some years ago when I was at the end of sitting a retreat with Marcia here, we all had this go around. And I had talked to Tenzin Jesse when we broke silence. And I called her on the phone and she said, oh, one of the Bodhi hearts is having a really bad problem with alcoholism and nobody knew, and suddenly the whole lid is blown off. I was so shocked, right? Because this individual was a very upstanding, reliable person. So I was like, oh, wow. So that was very much on my mind. We broke silence and I asked the whole gang, because I knew I'm looking at these absolutely like unadulterated Theravada practitioners who are just practicing in this Vipassana world. So let me just ask them my big $64,000 question. Like, what do you guys drink, and what do you think about people who drink? On like this. And then Marcia, she said, oh, that's kind of an interesting question. We never discourse on sila. And I thought, really? So anyway, I felt it would be good to do that. And that it is a really beautiful thing to do the analytical meditation where you're looking from every side. Strengthens mindfulness. It strengthens also the joy in your own virtue. And those strengths, like I say, are ones of calming and beauty, of perfume. They're an ornament to your life. There's something that it's a gift that you give to beings limitlessly, and it enriches your life. So I feel really honored and grateful and privileged to have spent this week with you, to the interviews also, very intimate and uplifting, to share with you the sincerity and your explorations into the material and also into your meditation. So let's close with our quiet prayers of aspiration. We began something and we finished it with tremendous benefit. So let's make the prayers of aspiration that we are good students of Dharma, that we will be like a good pot in which what is dropped in stays in there, right? We don't want to be like a pot that's going to tip over and spill out all the stuff and never think again about this. We have a wish to retain, to hold in mind, to digest, to integrate, to apply, and to be supported by the bliss and cool, refreshing happiness of blamelessness. So this is my aspiration that I offer you.